You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
James C. Jenkins and William M. Law. They are the authors of At the Cold Shoulder of History, the chilling story of a 21-year-old Navy hospital corpsman who stood at the shoulder of JFK during the Bethesda autopsy. Okay, so we're talking about the brain that it didn't look like it even fit into the skull, that the arteries weren't quite as they should be because they were constricted. The brainstem was questionable. And did you think at the time there's something really wrong with this picture? And you also talked about the lackadaisical way that they took off the covering and just instead of putting it in the bucket that it should have been put in, they just tossed it on the floor. You talked about how things were should have been taken care of, should have been burned or laundered. Certain things needed to be laundered and certain things need to be burned. And things just weren't taken care of. And there were also other people involved that came in that you kind of wondered, well, who are these people?
Well, most of the people that were in there were in there. In order to get into the morgue, my understanding is that your name had to be on the list. Of course, Paul and I were already in the morgue before the body ever came in. We were preparing it, so I don't know if we were on the list or not. The autopsy, the procedures that we used in doing an autopsy were pretty much the same procedures that we did that night. Because of the head wound and so forth, and also because it was the president, everything was a little bit more intense than we would normally have seen. But the head, what we normally did what you were discussing is actually the removal of the wrapping from the head that Dr. Humes did.
Right.
And when he removed it, instead of putting it in the waste bucket, it was underneath the head of the autopsy table. He just threw it on the floor.
Right.
That was just something that I remember because, as I said before, I knew that Paul or I, one of us, going to have to clean up the mess.
And you're talking about Paul.
I don't really think that. Yeah. Paul O'Connor. Paul was the other corpsman that was involved. That was my counterpart that night.
Okay.
It was just something that fixed the memory because of it was unusual, but again too. The whole autopsy itself, it was more the atmosphere that was intense. There was direction coming from the gallery to Dr. Humes. There are certain situations that happened during the autopsy. it appeared to me was that on the afterthought, after the autopsy, a couple of years later, when I actually saw the results of the Warren Commission and so forth, it really didn't. You know, I really hadn't thought much about what had occurred and that night. I remembered what I actually participated in and what I heard and what I had seen.
Sure, you were just doing your job and doing the things that you knew had to be done, and you probably weren't really concentrating or thinking about anything but doing your job, correct?
Well, that is correct, because, you know, Paul and I were the only enlisting men that were in the morgue constantly. They were actually participating in the autopsy. Other than, you know, the photographer and the X-ray technician.
Right. Now,
which,
there was a...
You know, after they finished...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean
to... After they finished taking the X-rays, you know, they didn't remain in the morgue. So, as I said before, Paul and I were... Plus, we were, you know, we were third-class hospital corpsmen, and everything in that morgue outranked us considerably.
Right.
So we were very attentive to what we were required to do, and our purpose being there was to assist the doctors in whatever they needed to have
sure.
done. And Paul and I both had assisted in autopsies before, and we had the duty that night. So that's the reason we were there.
Now, wasn't there an alternative place that the autopsy could have been done in Washington, D.C., but somehow his body ended up in, not the casket that he was put in Parkland, but in another casket?
Well, actually, there's multiple areas there that the autopsy should have been done. As a matter of fact, the AFIP, which is the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, they would have probably been the choice for an autopsy like that. And when the body came in, or when we were first told that we were actually going to get the body, I asked one of the duty officers, our NCO, the non-commissioned officer, first class, that went down to the morgue originally with Paul and I, why were we doing it? And he said it was probably because the president was Navy. And then later on, after the autopsy and so forth, I was told that Ms. Kennedy had requested it be done at Bethesda.
Right, which I kind of... And wasn't there a assistant photographer there whose camera was confiscated?
Well, there was a... Yeah, there was a civilian photographer that was actually in charge of the medical photography school there. His name was John Stringer. After the initial head was unwrapped, the hospital one, or the photographer, the medical photographer who was military, took some photographs of the head initially before Stringer came in. And that I was later told that there was a commotion in the back. I remember kind of offhand of the commotion, but I didn't really know what was going on. And later I was told that one of the Secret Service had taken the camera from the medical photographer and exposed the front of the film. I'm not sure for what reason, but...
That would be Floyd Reeby that got his film taken. He was apparently taking some film, and for whatever reason, the Secret Service agent decided he shouldn't be doing that. He was the assistant to John Stringer. And so the agent right. supposedly took the camera away from him. There was a short scuffle and exposed the film to light. So that's where that story comes from.
Okay. Wow. So apparently there were things that people didn't want to be revealed or shown.
Have you ever seen the autopsy photographs that are out in the public? Deanna, have you seen the autopsy photographs?
No.
The what's available to the public is basically, as far as we know, what is in the archives, or so we've been told, but we can't get in to see the so-called originals. And John Stringer has been called one of the best, if not the best in the world, taking photographs. And yet these autopsy photographs are just terrible. You can't really tell much from them. They didn't, there are normal procedures for measuring things so that you can get, you know, where the wounds are if the person has been killed by a gunshot. There's none of that. And I think that was purposely done so that we could be misled. And they had to have a set of autopsy photographs for the people that they had to show them to at the time. There's all kinds of controversy in this autopsy. There's controversy from the time that the president is shot and assassinated in Dallas and at the Bethesda Naval Autopsy. And you would think that over the years, some of these things would come together and we would be able to understand them better. But instead, as the years go by, it just gets stranger and stranger and stranger. And the more evidence that comes to light points to the fact that there was shenanigans going on in President Kennedy's autopsy.
Right. Which is evident just in reading this book. And obviously it's for a reason. They did not want to show or reveal where he had actually been shot. And so they did some, before he even arrived, they did some clever, what would you call it? Where they tried to conceal.
They did some manipulation as best they could. But somewhere along the lines, I think they had this thing mapped out, and then somewhere along the line, they lost control, and then they had to fly seat of their pants, and so they just kind of had to do things as the time was going by. For instance, there was the 400-pound casket that the president was put into in Dallas at Parkland, and then you have the at 6:30 to 6:35 in that time frame, we have interviewed someone, Dennis David, whose story is well known, that said he gave orders to six or seven enlisted men at Bethesda to take in a cheap metal shipping casket that contained the president's body.
Wow.
And that the body actually wound up there at Bethesda in a cheap metal shipping casket.
My goodness. Now, do you think that a lot of these stories that are promulgated actually to take people off the, away from the truth? I've heard that, oh my goodness, that it was his wife that shot him, or that it was the driver that shot him, or there's so many theories, and I'm sure they're designed to mess with people, to really take them away from the truth. What are your thoughts on that?
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, my thoughts are, I don't put much credence in those type of stories because there's actually no evidence to support it.
Right.
I've heard multiple things. To be honest with you, and I need to probably say this at this time, I know very little about what happened outside the morgue. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is that I've never really been attuned to are interested in the JFK assassination other than, you know, the information that I had. So I really haven't followed it. I haven't read
it. Which is good.
Even though people have sent me, you know, I have a bookcase here behind me that's filled with books. I haven't read those. They sent them to me basically because they either read an interview that maybe William did or someone else. And I've had, once my name was released by the House Select Committee, I get multiple phone calls about this. There are things that are out there that are, you know, there's no way to substantiate them. If you can't substantiate something or at least have something that points toward it, then it really makes no sense to even work with it.
Sure.
I think that, you know, the researchers that have done this, of course, the first one that I'm familiar with was David Lifton and Harry Livingstone, Doug Horne. I have an immense respect for these individuals and the amount of work and time that they've spent researching this. But I don't, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that they say. I think that some of the premises that they started with were false to begin with. And of course, if you start with a false premise, you come up with a false conclusion. Now, that's not to say that everything is wrong and so forth. I think the focus on the premise what it led to afterwards may not be exactly accurate. But again, too, I also have to say as a caveat, you know, the memories that I have are 55 years old.
But it's primary sources. You're using primary sources rather than secondary. You are using information that occurred at the time of the event. So it's primary. It's you were there. It's primary evidence rather than secondary or something made up. And as you say, based on false premises. So,
because it is primary source material that I'm using. I go directly to the person that was there.
Right.
So as Paul O'Connor, Jim's partner in the morgue, used to tell me, when he would be questioned and people wouldn't believe what he said, or they had a different idea about what happened in the morgue, he would say, "We were there, they weren't." And I have to agree with that.
Right. Absolutely. You have to use proper sources, and you should cite your sources so that people can go to those sources and clarify for themselves that what you are saying is accurate. And if you're just making if you're just speculating and dreaming things up and you don't cite your sources, then it's just hearsay.
Well, that's absolutely right. And things have to be documented before you can really print them. I everybody has a theory about what happened to John F. Kennedy, and nobody wants to hear my theory. When I was reading books and getting into this, I couldn't take one more time. I would read in this person's book a chapter that usually starts out, "What really happened?" You know, if you weren't in that autopsy room, as far as I'm concerned, you don't know what happened.
Right.
And so that's why I work in the area that I do and talk to the people that I've talked to over these decades, is because they were there. Just tell me what you saw and did and what you heard. I've been very lucky.
Right. You've taken the chances, as you did with James. Gentlemen, we do have a quick 3-minute break, and James will pick up where we left off here with you. Okay, you're right back. Stay with us.
Attention RBN listeners. Dr. Ignatius Piazza, founder of Frontsight Firearms Training, and Fate have come together to allow RBN to run another fundraiser till the end of the year. We didn't really expect this opportunity, but thankfully, it's here and running as you hear this. We've set a goal of 500 donations by the end of the year, which averages around 6 per day, 7 days a week. When you realize all the folks listening to RBN all hours of the day and night, we think our goal is realistic and extremely critical to keep RBN on the air. If everybody listening will seriously assess their ability with firearms and then take advantage of this opportunity, we feel our goal is very conservative. Please take the time to look over FrontSight's website to get an idea of an amazing facility and the world-class training that's going on there. If this interests you, you likely will have like-minded friends that would like to know. Tell them. If for some reason some listeners are not personally interested, consider sons and daughters, close friends, nieces or nephews, top-valued employees, inform club members, share the opportunity with police and fire departments. It's not too early to plan Christmas presents for special people. This fundraiser has come at an extremely critical time for RBN because the dire need for equipment upgrades. We're running on the spare tire currently with no money to fix a flat, and the fuel gauge is bouncing on E. This is one of the most valuable ways you can help RBN financially because you get Commander lifetime membership value that is 50 times your donation and can be passed on forever. How many times during life do you get to leave a legacy? See more details and contact info on our webpage, republicbroadcasting.org, and thank you.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to aroutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AirOutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more, plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to aroutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at aroutfitting.com.
Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guests today are James C. Jenkins and William M. Law. And James, you were about to make some points there.
Well, basically what I was wanting to say was the reason that I worked with William from the, at the beginning was what William and I, what I actually told William at the interview in New Orleans was exactly what he printed. And I think that's very important, especially to the credibility of the book that we've finished. And that there's no speculation. William doesn't have an agenda to work to, or at least I haven't found that in the 20 years I've known him. His purpose is actually to get the information out, let the reader make the decisions for himself, and I hope that the reader understands that when they read the book, I'm not really trying to convince them of any point that I have. It's basically I want the information out there, and I encourage the reader to make their own evaluations of the information that's in the book.
Right. And I really appreciate that.
That's really the purpose of the book.
I really do appreciate that and the detail. And it's very obvious that you were there and that you know exactly what you were talking about. Now, did you go on to become a doctor as your goal was, as you intended to?
No, I actually, my highest education at the point, I have a master's in Lyme Clinical Sciences of Pathology, Anatomy, and Embryology. Not embryology, I'm sorry, immunology.
Wow, okay. So you're in that field.
Yes, I've been in the field all my life, or all my adult life. I've been in the medical field.
Right.
And one aspect to the other.
Right. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about what occurred that you questioned or that you questioned afterwards or that you noted and wondered about. And
well, okay, little things that were unusual that I thought. After the head had been unwrapped by Dr. Humes and Dr. Fink were examining the head, and they found a small wound on the right side of the head in the temporal area. It was slightly forward and a little above the right ear. It was a small wound. It was probably no larger than the end of the tip of your little finger. And Dr. Fink, it was in the hairline, so it was a little difficult to see. But as they were moving the hair around, you know, you could see that the margins of the wound were gray. They were kind of a dark gray, almost purplish type. And so the discussion between Dr. Humes and Dr. Fink was, you know, what could that possibly mean? And Dr. Fink said, well, you know, it could be a lead discoloring from a bullet. Well, while they were doing that, while they were examining that wound, Dr. Humes got called over to the gallery, and by one of the generals that was there, had a discussion with him, came back, and then told Dr. Humes, "We need to get on the back, on the wound in the back of the head," and they left that wound, and they never. And they never returned to it. It was never returned to that night during the autopsy. I thought that was a little unusual.
This general, what was his?
Well, I was told that it was General Berkeley or Dr. Berkeley, the president's personal physician, was doing that. And that, and during the examination of the body and during the autopsy, Dr. Humes was constantly being called over to the gallery to talk to someone. And every time that he went and came back, the tension just increased considerably. The tension in the morgue that night was like the proverbial atmosphere that you could cut with a knife. And the animosities between there were four officers standing at the rail in the gallery, from the table. And, they seemed to be directing what was going on with the pathologist. And, the animosities began to build between those people and the pathology people, the three pathologists. It was something that you really couldn't avoid. And of course, you know, I was there stable with them, and I was totally insignificant at that point in time. But it started when we did the first set of X-rays. And we found no no bullet fragments, no large fragments, no bullet fragments at all. And then the second X-ray, the people in the gallery, when I say people in the gallery, I'm talking about these four individuals, they were a little upset about the fact is that there was nothing found. So they ordered the X-rays be repeated. And then Gerald Custer, who was the X-ray tech, and his assistant, he had brought back after he took the first set of X-rays. He and I took the first set of X-rays. And when he came back, he brought an assistant with him who was one of their students. And then they took the second set of X-rays, and there was no... again, there was no fragments, nothing found, and so forth. So at that point in time, they called Dr. Ebersol, who was the pathologist, not the pathologist, the radiologist at that time. And he came in and directed the third set of X-rays. And after they were developed, they found the same result. But when Dr. Ebersol and Custer brought those X-rays back, they also brought a bank of X-ray viewing boxes, set them up, and they put all the X-rays on them. And then the four people from the gallery came down, I think the two FBI agents at that time had come in, and then other people came in. They all went over and to view the X-rays, and they still found nothing. So they concluded that, and Dr. Humes, Dr. Fink went back to examining the head. The brain was removed. We infused it, and then Dr. Boswell motioned for me to assist him or to help him do the body autopsy. And he did the incision. We took what we normally did. We tied off the major arteries and so forth, and we removed the organs from the body and placed them on a cutting board, or a dissection board that I placed over the body. And we did, Dr. Boswell and I, we did the normal autopsy of the body proper, and then we came back. When we came back from that, Dr. Humes, Dr. Fink had actually resected the scalp from the wounded area, and at that time you could actually see the true borders of the wound itself, where the bone and scalp were missing. And its appearance were quite different from what it appeared to be whenever the head was initially unwrapped. And
now there was a shot to the temple, right?
There was a wound in the right temple. It was just in the hairline. As I said, it was in the temple area. Just slightly above the right ear and slightly forward of that. But it still remained in the hairline. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I left the morgue that night, I had seen three wounds that I knew. The one was in the right temple. The one was in the parietal occipital posterior portion of the skull, in the back of the skull. And the other one was in the back, at upper back, at the kind of between the upper edge of the scapula, which is actually the shoulder bone, I guess, and the spinal cord, or spinal column. Mm-hmm. And I saw, of course, the large gash in the neck, but during the autopsy, we had been told that that was an emergency trach and not to bother with it, so it wasn't examined that night.
Really?
At least in that morgue.
Mm-hmm.
As we were doing the body autopsy, you know, we do the incision, take the flap, and we should lay it back over and take the chest plate off. Well, as that kind of exposes the upper portion of the lungs and the trachea in that area, but Dr. Boswell kind of lifted a little bit and looked in there, but that was all of the examination that was done that night. As far as that, the throat wound. So I just assumed, and I left the morgue thinking that was kind of a unusual, atrocious tracheotomy, but I did believe at that point in time that it was, because I had been told that it was a tracheotomy. It was an emergency tracheotomy. Didn't make sense, but it's still, that's what I was told. And, you know, in those days, I was just starting out, and that was the first introduction I really had to medicine, other than core school, and so I really didn't question.
Now, this was a naval hospital, and you said that there was more than one general, did you say?
Oh, yeah. I knew Admiral Galloway. Admiral Galloway was in charge of the Bethesda Naval Complex there. And I knew, I really didn't know the other three people. And today I'm not sure who two of them are. But they were Army and judging from the uniforms, they were Army, Air Force, and I guess they were, I didn't see any Marine uniforms there, but they're mostly Army and so forth. And they were all generals. They were all flag rank.
Would you attribute that to the fact that it was the president that was being autopsied?
Yes, I would. Someone has told me in the past that there was probably someone that asked me about General McChrystal or someone of that nature, and I couldn't identify him. I didn't know who they were. I'd never met any of them or had an opportunity to even see their picture or anything of that nature. So I didn't really know who they were and couldn't identify them. I just remembered that and knew that they were generals.
Jim, if I could break in here for just a second, I think what you're referring to is the story about General Curtis LeMay being in the autopsy room. Years and years ago, Paul O'Connor told me that he had that there was a guy that was a general smoking a big cigar. And Humes told Paul, he said, go over there and tell that guy to put that cigar out. So Paul started walking over, and he recognized him as Curtis LeMay, and he turned around and went back to Humes and said, that's Curtis LeMay. And Humes said, well, you didn't say anything to him, did you? And so I think that's what you were referring to. It was supposed to be Curtis LeMay.
That's interesting.
That may be, again, like I said, I can't really identify any of them except with the exception of Admiral with the Admiral Galloway.
Now, they said that the gash in the throat was because they were attempting to help the president breathe. If he were shot in the head, would that make any sense?
Can we dig in a little bit here? Yeah.
Let's talk about how the wounds looked in Dallas, okay?
Yes.
The as the body was seen in Dallas, Texas, when they brought him in, and they cut the clothing away. There were nurses that made cut downs on one of his arms and one of his legs to put in Ringer's lac tape, which is basically salt water. The wound to the head, as they described it, was in the back, and it was about the size of a big orange, or a small orange, or a big egg. There was a bullet hole that was in the president's throat about the knot of the tie that was about as round as the end of your little finger. So after the president passed, they put him into a 400-pound display casket lined with some sort of plastic so that the fluids would not leak out on the into the casket lining, wrapped his head in sheets and his body in sheets. And the casket was then transported to Love Field, where then it went to Andrews Air Force Base, and then from there to Bethesda Naval Hospital. By the time that the wounds had been saved, we won't even get into the discrepancies about the casket. Let's just talk about how the wounds looked after they took the body out and put the president on the autopsy table. The wound to the head now encompasses the back part of the side, part of the top of the head. So it's expanded some 4 to 5 times larger than what was seen in Dallas, Texas. The throat wound, referred to as a tracheotomy incision, that was about the size of the end of your little finger, is now a big, open, ugly, gaping gash. So the wounds and the wrappings on the body, as Paul O'Connor described it, Jim's partner in the morgue that night, said the president's body came into the morgue in a cheap metal shipping casket. Inside the cheap metal shipping casket was a body bag. They unzipped the body bag, and the president was in the body bag. He was nude except for sheets wrapped around his head. So the body wrappings were different. The casket was different. And the wounds looked different as described in Dallas and then described in Bethesda.
Now, do you think, or do you know, whether there were any meetings between the doctors at Parkland and those at Bethesda? This would be speculation, but...
Well, for the record, they had no contact. That's the official story.
And actually, that night during the morgue, I saw no contacts, no phone calls. Either. Actually, there had been a phone call from one of the pathologists to Parkland, and what we would have, you know, they would have had to have used a phone that was there in the morgue, and it would have been obvious that they were talking to someone, and I did not see that at all. I would like to say something, though, is that when Paul helped them remove the body from casket. The body came to the table where I was and was put on the table. The body at that time was wrapped in sheets. The body was wrapped in a single sheet or in one layer sheet. And the head was wrapped in a sheet and a underlying wrap that appeared to be a towel.
However, I'm not particularly there were no towels in Dallas. I'm in possession of a tape now that has not been heard in 20-some years. I'm writing about it now, that one of the nurses who put packing inside the president's head and helped wrap the body said that there was no towel. It was a sheet. But Jim saw a towel.
I talked to Nurse Audrey Bell in Dallas, along with Dr. McClellan and I believe Dr. Williams. And when I was comparing what we saw at Bethesda with what they saw in Dallas. Now, once the appearance of the head wound was misleading as soon as the wrappings were taken off, because it looked like that the appearance was a huge amount of matted blood, soaked hair, tissue, and so forth, that you would expect. It seemed to be a blowout of the back of the head. That was extremely misleading, because until you reflected the scalp, you couldn't see the true borders of the skull, of the wound in the skull. And the wound in the skull, as far as dimensions and shape, appeared to be somewhat consistent with what they had seen in Dallas. There were exceptions to it. There was a incision from the top of the wound that went forward that tracked kind of parallel to the top of the head, but it tracked over some of the fracture lines in the skull that were where the bones were still being held together by the skull. And when the wrapping was taken off, the secondary wrapping kind of was stuck to the matted hair and so forth, and the wound gaped open. It made it to appear to be a huge wound, but as soon as the wrappings were removed, it closed back, and the only wound at that point in time was just where the bone and the scalp were missing. Dr. Humes, as they were examining the head, and especially this laceration that went forward to the frontal part of the skull, it seemed that it was a series of rents and tears from the passage, you know, from the wound or from the projectile that had been neatly connected surgically. Because they were very neat connections. It wasn't like the tear and the raggedness of the other rents that were there. And this this went forward.
Do you suppose was that done in Dallas? Was there work done in Dallas,
no,
or was there?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't obvious in Dallas. It was like it was almost like, because Dr. Humes actually asked someone in the gallery, have they done surgery in Dallas, and he was told no, they had not.
Because is it possible that they appeared. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Is it possible that something was done aboard the airplane from Dallas to Bethesda?
I really can't answer where it was done. There's too many possibilities, but
sure.
But I do believe that the body was the wounds were examined, and possibly anything that was remaining in the wound was removed. Any metal fragments or anything of that nature that you would normally expect to find were removed.
Was removed, right.
Right. It seemed as if during the autopsy, and this is my reflection years later, that it was being directed toward a conclusion, a predetermined conclusion, and that when the evidence strayed from that, then that's when the people in the gallery began to apply more pressure to the pathologist.
Oh.
And
let me break in here for a moment and talk about. I interviewed the two FBI agents that were told by J. Edgar Hoover to stay with Kennedy's body and take back any evidence that was found in the body back to the FBI laboratory. And they both, in their notes, the reason this is controversial and came to the fore was because in the 5.5 pages of notes they wrote, there's this statement from the FBI. It says there's been a tracheotomy performed as well as surgery of the head area, namely in the top of the skull. So they said that they didn't write that. They wrote that because one of the doctors said, has there been surgery, or words to that effect. In later years, Frank O'Neill wrote a book or had a chapter that he had given to the Records Review Board. And in reading that material, nobody had noticed it. So I sent and got, I called the people there at Special Records Collection. I guess we can get back.
Oh, okay. We have a 3-minute break. We will be right back with our guest today, James C. Jenkins and William M. Law. Be right back.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard. Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Do you know there is an ongoing war right here in America? Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Welcome back to our guests, and they are James C. Jenkins and William M. Law. And there's a question in the chat room. And James, are you certain that it was the president's body at Bethesda? Is it possible that it wasn't?
I'm certain it was. I've been asked the question many times, and at autopsy we did a characterization of of body marks and wounds and so forth. And we place it on a form called the face sheet, or we call it a face sheet. And Dr. Boswell and I did that face sheet. I wrote in the wounds, the scars, and so forth. And the scars on the back of the body that we had were actually those that the president had, the wounds that he had acquired in World War II. So I felt like that was enough identifying characteristics to make me sure that the body that we had was the president's body. There were other things that, were related to it. As we did, we did the autopsy. The appearance of the lungs were nice and pink, and there was a question to the gallery, did he smoke? And they said no, just an occasional cigar. That was an unusual occurrence. It would have been extremely difficult in a short period of time to create those type of scars. He had an appendix scar that was in his medical record. All of those things, plus the fact is that he had suffered from Addison's disease, and the kidneys that we took at autopsy had a wasting and atrophy of the adrenal glands. Virtually no adrenal glands were present.
So, really?
And so all of those things were well documented and could be compared to his medical records and historical records of his PT incident in the war. So I feel fairly certain that the body that we had was the body of JFK.
Okay. Now, William, do you have anything to add at this point?
You know, I've heard that before about asking if it was a different body. There's an interesting story Jim's told me, and I've heard over the years that there was another casket there that supposedly contained the body of an Air Force colonel, that they were told to just leave it alone. Don't touch it. The body had already been prepared, but he had gotten in too late to be buried at Arlington, so that they were going to keep him there until Monday and then bury him at Arlington. So the casket was pushed up against the coal boxes, and nobody bothered with it. They were told not to log it in. But then after the autopsy was finished and over, Jim, as he was cleaning the morgue, happened to notice that casket was no longer there. So that casket was supposed to stay there, according to the story they were told, until Monday. But after the autopsy of the president is over and he's been placed in another casket and taken out, that casket supposedly containing the Air Force Major was gone. So I think that was part of the little scenario that was going on. I don't know what the scenario was. It just points to there being shenanigans going on with President Kennedy's body, which leads to this speculation that there was another body that was there that they were using to photograph that was possibly a Kennedy lookalike. Now, I've heard this over and over and over again. I don't know if that's true or not, but I don't write about it unless I have some proof of it. And so far, there's been no proof established for that kind of thing.
Okay. Gotcha.
And, what William's referring to is that there was a casket that was brought into the morgue, and it had been pushed up against the coal boxes in the anteroom. And I had